this is superior force. So ultimately, we have to build up our strength such that we can overcome their resistance and carve out, by force if necessary, a Jewish state in this land, or transform it into a Jewish state, however long that takes, and by whatever means prove necessary. Most Zionist leaders were uncomfortable with that formulation, but I think that reflects the logic of the situation very clearly. And this is, I think, very graphically demonstrated in the later 1930s when, in 1936, there was a full-scale Arab revolt against British rule and against the Zionist enterprise, which British rule protected, which went on for 3 years and which was only crushed by the use of massive military force by the British, which in many ways broke the back of the Arab nationalist movement and set the stage for its defeat in 1948. But again, without British protection and support and military might, the growing Jewish community in Palestine, the Zionist project, would likely have gone down the drain or come to an end in one form or another. So by the late 1930s, Jews are an increasing proportion of the population, still a minority. They're a minority down to 1948. The Jewish population surges in the 1930s because of what's going on in Europe, essentially. In 1933, the Nazis come to power in Germany and begin stripping German Jews of their citizenship and persecuting them, discriminated against them. There's growing anti-Semitism elsewhere, in Poland, for example, which has a very large Jewish population, the largest Jewish population of anywhere in Europe. And of course, this is also the period of the Depression, when the economic situation is very difficult for everyone. And many Jews would like to emigrate, but they no longer can go to the United States or go to many Western countries. The United States closes its gates to immigration in 1924. There's a wave of nativism, of reaction to immigration, and essentially after legislation in 1924, you have to be from Scandinavia to get into the United States. It's very difficult for anyone else. The U.S. shuts the gates, and so does France and Britain to various extents. Whereas Palestine, at least, is relatively open. So a great many German Jews and Jews from elsewhere come to Palestine because they have no alternative. Even if they're not committed Zionists, this is where they can go to get out of the very difficult situation in their home countries. And so the Jewish population surges, which also sets the stage for the Arab revolt, because suddenly it seems to Arabs that this Zionist idea of a Jewish majority and Jewish state is becoming imaginable for the first time. It's no longer a fantasy which, you know, maybe will happen in several generations. Jews are now moving on a third of the population, and they're increasingly well-developed. It's increasingly has strong economic foundations, again, political institutions, military institutions, on and on. So it looks like a state in the making. And this touches off the revolt, the Arab revolt of 1936-39. The revolt is crushed, and in many ways ends up strengthening the Jewish community in Palestine, because it's forced into self-sufficiency, it's forced to develop its military institutions, it successfully withstands this revolt with British protection, of course, such that by 1939, the Jewish community in Palestine, the Yishuv, led by and part of the Zionist movement, is much, much closer to being able to stand on its own, which is very useful because in 1939, the British government, understanding that a new war is looming on the horizon, begins to distance itself from Zionism. It changes policy and basically says, look, we've fulfilled our promises under the Balfour Declaration, we've supported you in creating a national home for the last 20 years, but now enough is enough, we've done what we said, we need to reconcile Arab opinion, which of course is deeply alienated from the British, and the British need the Middle East with the coming war. They need Arab support, they need its oil resources, they need its strategic location. So they back away from Zionism. But by this point, in a way, Zionism has struck down strong enough roots in Palestine so that it can stand on its own even without the kind of British support it had enjoyed for the previous 20 years. You then have the Second World War, which leads to the extermination of most of the Jews of Europe, which was the mass base which Zionism had always imagined it would eventually bring to Palestine. And Zionism emerged with the argument that there was no future for Jews in Europe, that ultimately they would have to come to the Palestine where they could create a state of their own. And even though only a minority did so, They always imagined that the millions of Jews in Europe would be their future reservoir for the population of the future Jewish state. As the war proceeded, the vast majority of those Jews were murdered. And at the end of the war, Zionism found itself without that mass base, or a small remnant remained. This energized the Zionist movement in a sense. And during the war, for the first time, it began to state very unequivocally that it wanted a Jewish state. It had fudged the language before that, hence the sort of national home. They didn't want to alienate the Arabs or others by talking about a state too explicitly. Now, during the war, they begin calling for a state. And immediately, once the war is over, launch a campaign, a quite successful campaign, to first open up Palestine to Jewish immigration, because the British have imposed restrictions, and then a drive for a Jewish state, which brings them into conflict with the British government. But the Zionist movement, for the first time, has won tremendous international sympathy because of the murder of the Jews of Europe. For the first time, its argument seems much more plausible to a lot of people. Of course, there are other ways of understanding it, but for many people, it seems that supporting the Zionist project of creating a Jewish state in Palestine is reasonable compensation for what the Jews of Europe experienced, the extermination, the suffering, and so forth. And so there's growing sympathy in the United States, especially, which is emerging after 1945, which does emerge in 1945 as the world's superpower, for Zionism, and pressure on the British to open up Palestine to more immigration. And the Zionist movement launches a quite successful diplomatic campaign, lobbying campaign, but also in Palestine, a sort of insurgency to force the British to open up Palestine, to challenge British rule, and sets the stage for Britain being ready to give up its mandate and turning the whole issue over to the United Nations. And the United Nations, after conducting an investigation, comes to the conclusion in the fall of 1947 that Jews who are now little under one-third of the population, and Arabs, two-thirds plus of the population of Palestine, cannot live together in one state, and that the best solution is to divide Palestine into two states. So this is a tremendous victory for Zionism. Even if many Zionists would have liked all of Palestine or more of it than the one-half they were allocated by the United Nations plan, that's still much, much better than nothing, right? Finally, the United Nations seems ready to support the idea of a Jewish state. Needless to say, the Arab majority in Palestine and the Arab national movement and Arabs everywhere reject this. Again, they see this as a gross violation of the Palestinian Arabs' right to self-determination and vow to prevent it. And when the United Nations General Assembly endorses the partition plan, fighting breaks out in Palestine between Arabs and Jews. By this point, the Jewish forces, the Zionist forces, are strong enough to both hold their ground and within a few months defeat the poorly armed, poorly organized, poorly led Palestinian militias and take the offensive. And in May 1948, the Zionist leadership in Palestine proclaims the existence of a Jewish state, which it names Israel. And that's followed immediately by the intervention of military forces from the Arab states to prevent partition, to protect the Palestinians, who are already being displaced, whether because they're fleeing from the fighting or because they're being deliberately expelled by the Jewish and then the Israeli military forces. When the fighting ends, Israel is in control of three-quarters of what was once Palestine, so a lot more, 50% more than the United Nations had allocated originally to the Jewish state. There is no Palestinian Arab state. That never emerges for a variety of reasons having to do with the ambitions of the Arab states. And 80% of the Arabs, of the Palestinians who lived in the territory that now becomes Israel, have been dispossessed. The great majority of them either have been expelled by Israeli military forces from their villages, from their towns, from their neighborhoods, or do what civilians do when there's fighting. They fled to get away from the fighting and then found themselves on the wrong side of the border. And Israel made it clear that they could not return and promptly began to demolish their villages, take over their neighborhoods, allocate their fields to neighboring settlements, and so on. And then, so you have the creation of the Palestinian refugee problem through this act of dispossession, which many people have defined as an act of ethnic cleansing, in effect, although that term was not around at the time. So in many senses, this Zionism is as a movement a tremendous success, right? It, from the sort of half-baked idea of these little groups in Eastern Europe, and the notions, the rather grandiose notions of a Viennese journalist in the late 1890s, to actually carving out a state in Palestine and being able to defeat opposition both internally from the Palestinians and externally from the surrounding Arab states, is a tremendous historical achievement for this movement, and help win for solidify the support Zionism had won from many Jews who, until that time, including many American Jews, had been rather ambivalent. Reform Jews in the United States were very anti-Zionist, even later, but ultimately came to terms with it. Many Orthodox Jews who had originally been very anti-Zionist also came to terms with the existence of Israel, even if they didn't see themselves as Zionists. It was a fact. They became part of the new system. So from that point of view, Zionism was a tremendous success. The state which Zionism brought into being, the State of Israel, remains shaped by its origins, in a sense. It remains a Zionist state in some very concrete senses. First and foremost, Israel doesn't define itself as a state of its citizens. Right? The United States is a state of its citizens. If one comes to the United States, or one is born in the United States, and one becomes or is born a citizen, you, at least in principle, have equal rights with every other citizen. We know about racism, we know about the long history of the United States and struggles to actually make that real, but in principle, everybody who's a citizen in the United States has equal rights, and nobody who's not a citizen has special rights. And that's true of liberal democracies generally. That's one of the hallmarks of liberal democracies. Israel doesn't define itself as a state of its citizens. It defines itself as a state of all Jews everywhere. And that's embodied in various laws such that, for example, any Jew from anywhere in the world who wants to come to Israel can become a citizen automatically. Whereas a Palestinian whose ancestors may have lived in this land for many centuries and who happened to be elsewhere in 1947-48 doesn't have those rights and has to apply through naturalization, and Israel has made it pretty clear it's not interested in any more Palestinian citizens. Israel sees itself as a state of all Jews everywhere, claims to speak for all Jews everywhere, although not all Jews like that idea necessarily. Through that law of return, which grants automatic citizenship, through a whole range of state policies which seek to give Israel's Jewish citizens privileged access to resources, that special position for Jews within Israel is manifested. Something like 18% today of Israel's population, of Israel's citizens, we're talking about within Israel and its 1967 borders, are Palestinians, are Arabs. And they are the descendants of the remnant of the Arab population which remained within Israel's borders after 1948. So they are citizens, formally. They can vote in elections. But it's very clear that legally and institutionally, in many ways, they're second-class citizens. Again, they don't have the same automatic right of emigration. The state has systematically, since 1948, pursued policies of, for example, transferring land from Arab ownership or control to Jewish ownership and control, confiscating land from Arab landowners for Jewish settlements within the State of Israel proper. A whole host of means which advantage one segment of the population and disadvantage another segment of the population in a way which would never be seen as acceptable in the United States. Right? If the government of the United States said, you know, only Christian citizens can buy public land, people would think this is a gross violation of equal citizenship and oppose it. Right? Yet Israel privileges its Jewish majority in very structural sort of ways. If you look at the allocation of resources, Arab municipalities, Arab towns, Arab communities get far fewer resources for social services, for education, for a whole range of things than do equally sized Jewish towns, settlements, communities. All sorts of social benefits are allocated very disproportionately so that Jews benefit and Arabs do not, or benefit to a much lesser extent. And Israel has also worked very hard through its security apparatus to control its Arab population, to try to depoliticize them, to marginalize them, to make it more difficult for them to demand equal rights, as many have almost since 1948, and certainly more vigorously in recent years as their weight in the population, their level of education, and so on, has risen. So in its symbols, in its language, Israel talks about itself as a Jewish state, and there's no way that that cannot put its non-Jewish citizens in a subordinate position. And those non-Jewish citizens are increasingly resentful of that. And that's entirely separate from what happens in the occupied territories, what happens in the West Bank, Gaza, and so on, which Israel conquers in 1967. This would be an issue, even if that were resolved tomorrow, Israel would still face the issue of its Palestinian minority and the unequal status which that majority is subject to. So in these ways, Zionism still remains relevant, remains intrinsic to Israel's self-definition as a state and to a whole host of institutions, policies, and so on. It's this which sets the stage for debate, which has gone on for quite a few years, about whether Israel can in fact be both Jewish and democratic, whether there's not some contradiction here. If the state defines itself as Jewish, isn't it thereby inevitably subjecting its non-Jewish citizens to a subordinate status? Of course, if it's democratic, then it's not taking Jewishness or lack of Jewishness into consideration as a criterion for resources, for access, for a range of things. And then you have a very different kind of place. And in fact, one of the demands of Israel's Palestinian citizens in recent years has been that Israel should become a state of all its citizens, should become like the United States, where the government does not take religion or race, at least in principle, religion or race or ethnicity into account in terms of citizenship rights. It makes, at least in principle, no difference. We know, of course, historically it's made a lot of difference, and there's been an ongoing struggle to make that happen. But in principle, at least, that's the rule. That's not the case in Israel. The state of Israel classifies its population by nationality into Jews, Arabs, Druze, and so on. And until the last few years, this was stated on everyone's identity card. And it also classifies people by religion, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Druze, etc. Your status, both your national status as defined by Israeli law and policy, and your religious status make an important difference in your access to things, to resources, in ways which would never be tolerated in the United States, which would be seen as fundamentally contradictory to the core principles of a liberal democracy as practiced in the United States or in Britain or in France or elsewhere. So in that sense, Zionism remains on the agenda, so to speak. It's central to Israel's self-definition. It's important, of course, as well, because after 1967, when Israel conquered the remainder of Mandate Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza, there began a project which has only accelerated over the years for settling these territories, for establishing Jewish settlements, for making them Jewish, in a sense, or many of them, despite the fact that their population remains overwhelmingly Palestinian. And the settlers and those who support them argue that, in a way, this is just the continuation of what Zionism has been doing for the last century. And there is a certain logic to that, which made them very difficult to confront, even by those Israelis who thought the settlement project was a very bad idea, and that Israel should be willing to trade the West Bank and Gaza for peace, make some kind of compromise and divide Palestine with the Palestinians. The settlers and their allies argue that there's a lot of continuity here, that Israel should settle the West Bank as it settled parts of what became Israel in 1948. And, of course, they have a certain biblical history on their side, because the parts of Palestine in which Israel was established in 1948 are not really the parts which were the places where the events of the Bible took place, right? Those parts of the West Bank, first and foremost. So especially for religiously inspired nationalist settlers, the West Bank is much more important than Tel Aviv, right? The events of the Bible took place there. That's where Abraham walked. That's where all these things happened, according to the Bible at least, reality or mythology, who knows. So there's also a lot of emotional, historical impetus to that. So in that sense, Zionism remains alive too, because it's used as an argument for the colonization, the Judaification, and that's a term which is used in Hebrew, both for these territories, but also for parts of Israel, of the West Bank. Gaza was always less important. It had no particular historical or emotional resonance, but the West Bank has been the core of this. And those who favor it have a lot of ground to stand on from within the Zionist tradition to argue that these lands should also be colonized, annexed, or at least in their important parts, by Israel, that they're part of the land of Israel, all of which should belong, or does belong forever to the Jewish people. So in that sense, too, Zionism remains very much on the agenda as a factor, an ideological factor, a cultural factor in Israeli-Jewish society and politics. The question of Zionism is a very fraught one. It's a very sensitive one. I personally don't think it's been helped by the fact that there's a lot of crude Zionist bashing. Right? And Zionism has, in many circles, become synonymous with racism, with apartheid, with a range of things. And of course, one can see the elements of Zionism, you know, not as an abstract ideology, but in practice on the ground in Palestine, which support that. So I think we have to be careful, because for a lot of people, in the United States at least, for a lot of American Jews, I think identification with Israel is an important part of their Jewish identity. So I think one has to be very careful in dealing with this, because the way to win people over is to give them a better understanding of the situation. And just denouncing Zionism as racism probably isn't going to get you very far, as opposed to trying to find ways to reach people to acquire a better understanding of what concretely goes on the ground and of how those kinds of things, discriminatory practices within the state of Israel, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, all those things, you know, have links to how Israel defines itself and how it sees itself and to its origins as a Zionist state, as the product of a Zionist movement, which is comparable with all the differences to other kinds of settler movements which bring people to settle and ultimately to take over from an indigenous population. So that's a very difficult thing. I don't pretend to know exactly how to do this as effectively as one would like. But I think it's also not an impossible task. And I think, in fact, the American Jewish community is much less monolithic, perhaps than it once was, and certainly than its leaders, self-appointed leaders, often like to proclaim it to be. And I think many have been quite distressed by what they see going on. Right? Israel has lately launched a whole new propaganda campaign, because I think they understand that the image of Israel has eroded a great deal, even in the United States, not to speak of Europe, where public opinion, I think, is much more critical. And governments have been much more critical. But even in the United States, and even among Jews, the watching on one's television screen the Israeli assault on Gaza in December 2008, January 2009, was horrifying for a lot of people. And all the rationales that this is necessary for security, and if the Canadians were bombarding Maine, we would do the same thing, and on, don't sit well with a lot of people, and made people think, well, maybe these guys are a little bit out of control. Right, or they're overreacting, or you know, maybe something different needs to happen here, and that's created some space. And we see this with the emergence of J Street and challenges a little more space that's emerged within the Jewish community on the surface, and I think greater space beneath the surface, which it, at least is a hopeful sign. It may not go very far. It's very difficult to predict, but I think there's a possibility of disentangling that emotional identification with Israel with support for Israeli policies, blind support for Israeli policies. And that's, I think, a hopeful thing.
You were just listening to Zachary Lachman, A Brief History of Zionism. This classic from the AR Archives was recorded at NYU in 2010. Zachary Lachman is professor of Middle Eastern Studies and History at New York University. He's a contributing editor to Middle East Report. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Ilan Pape, Michael Parenti, Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Zachary Lachman, A Brief History of Zionism, and for Ilan Pape's book, 10 Myths About Israel, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. or go online our website, alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Will Singer. Jovich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at supportblackcharities.org.